Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Now, Charles Bronson is Britain's most notorious prisoner. Apart from a two-month period in the 1980s, he's been incarcerated since 1974, during which time he's attacked numerous other inmates and prison guards. Much of the time he's been spent in solitary or in psychiatric wings. Nonetheless, he's managed to write books about his experiences and reinvent himself as an artist. He's also managed to have relationships with women on the outside. For the second time, he's engaged, and on the line is his fiancée, Paula Williams. Good afternoon, Paula.
Hello, good afternoon, Sean.
What prompted you to first write to Charles?
What prompted me was reading a book of his called Broadmoor that I read. And yeah, that's what prompted me.
Yeah, and what was it about the book or what he wrote that made you want to contact him?
It was about the man's spirit, his sense of humour, his undeniable spirit in the face of a lot of harsh treatment that he received whilst he was incarcerated in Broadmoor, and his kind of fighting spirit mentally, I'm speaking about mental fighting spirit, that inspired me, and I wanted to write to him, so I did.
Right, and did you want to write to him to say, I kind of fancy you, or
no,
you were
God,
supporting
no.
him,
no.
or what?
No, I thought, well, at the time he was engaged anyway.
Right.
To a lady. When I actually read the book, I thought that he was released and now living this happy life, you know, with his fiancée. It was only when I started to Google him after reading it that I actually realised that this man's still incarcerated and is in high security prison here in the UK. I thought when I read it that he was already out and living life, so it was only after that I realised.
Oh, right. Okay. And did he respond to you fairly quickly?
I think it was about, I don't know, maybe about a week and a half or something like that. I didn't write expecting a response and like, oh, I can't wait until he writes back. I just wanted to say thank you very much for writing that. I found it really inspiring. It made me laugh out loud. It made me cry. It made me feel, because I've gone through sort of dark times in my past as well. And I think that Charlie, he just kind of helped put things in perspective, really. I thought, well, if this man can come out and still function, still have hope and still be moving forward in life, then you know, it's time to raise my game as well, and it kind of helped me a lot mentally.
When he replied to your letter, and you, as you say, you weren't expecting a reply, what did he say to you? How did that start then a correspondence between the two?
I think it was just, initially, it was just kind of, well, I wrote to him to say thank you for writing this. It's really uplifted my spirit. I think you were in parts hilarious. We've got the very, very similar, if not the same, sense of humour. And I just, initially, it was a thank you for writing it, not a thank you and please write back. It was just a thank you.
Mm.
And then he wrote back saying, oh, that's really, really kind of you to contact me. Yes, I'm still in Wakefield. Because as most people want to know, they kind of think, well, why are you still in there? When are you getting out? You know, what's going on with all of that? And so I think it took it from there, but he would tell me a bit about him and why he was still inside and about his hopes for the future. And it just went from there, really.
For you, when did it turn into something else other than just
exchanging? Oh, it was not until I met him, which was last November. Up until then, our letters had become more frequent. They were a little bit more cheeky in tone, put it that way. But they weren't sort of like really kind of romantic. At this point, I knew that he was single because him and his fiancée had long split up before that.
Right. You didn't steal him away from his fiancée, did you, Paula?
It's what, sorry?
You didn't steal him away from his fiancée,
No,
did
God,
you?
No. I would never steal anybody. No, not at all. In fact, I hardly ever asked about that. She was the secretary of his art foundation and did a lot of good for him. And that kind of came to its natural conclusion way, way, way before he met me.
The first time you were, because you must have been nervous then, I assume, in advance of meeting him.
On the way there, I mean, I've never been to a maximum secure prison in my life. And I went with a mutual friend of ours who had also, that was the first visit for him as well. And all the way there, I think it was more excitement about, oh God, we're going to see him at long last and all of this. It wasn't, the nerves did not kick in until, I mean, he lives in a prison within a prison. So you have to kind of go through all the mass amount of security, and then you go through to the area where he is. And it was at that point when I heard him shouting my name, I thought, oh my Lord, I'm about to meet, you know, Britain's, God, what am I doing? You know, meeting Britain's most notorious prisoner. And I could hear him shouting, Paula, Paula, is that you? Is that you there? And it was, yes, that was surreal, put it that way.
Did you both know what to do? It's kind of like, it sounds to me like, you know, that I don't know if you've ever had this experience that you follow somebody on Twitter and you might communicate with on Twitter for years on a regular, and then you meet them in real life and you don't know whether to, like, are we friends? Do we shake hands? Do we hug? What do we do?
Exactly the same. That's exactly how I would liken it too. You know, you have friends on Facebook and all this, and then eventually you meet and it is like, oh, I didn't expect your voice to be like that. Or we're so used to, I think nowadays we're so used to dealing sort of vicariously with people, and it's you know, we hardly pick on the phone much anymore, and we don't, you know, it's all message. So yeah, it was very, very similar to that. However, within sort of 5 minutes, we were sat there just gossiping away, and I mean, he was very excitable when I first met him, and he was like in the because it was an open visit, so we were in the same room, and the prison officer left us in the room, the door shuts behind. So I thought, oh, right, that's how it is, isn't it?
Right.
Thanks for that. I'm just let in here. I mean, obviously, you watched and monitored and everything else, but I expected it to be, since then he's been on closed visits, but he's now been put back on open ones. But, it was bizarre, but it was quickly, I'm the kind of person, I can meet people and I can chat away like I've known them for a long time anyway. So for me, it wasn't, I think my friend who I was with, he was more taken aback by me for the first hour of the visit, but it, you know, I was not too bad. It was, I just said, oh, come here, give me a hug for goodness sake.
Mm. And so how many times have you met him since then?
I did think this the other day, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe about 11 times or something like that, maybe more. When are we on November? No, it would be more than that. Of course it would.
Right, okay. So it's more than once a month you've been seeing each other. Oh, crikey then. That's probably twice a month then you've seen him.
Twice a month, exactly.
Then.
Twice a month. We speak about three or four times a week. He writes every day. And this has gradually been getting to this point since 2013. So it's not a kind of 5 minute overnight thing.
And so when you then, though, tell people that your friends and your family that you're getting married to him, what kind of range of reactions have you got?
Well, I mean, quite a varying range. I mean, my friends know that I am a strong-willed character, and I think they were sort of right. But I think even friends were doubtful to some degree. I mean, even my best friend who I lived with, he saw these letters steadily more and more and more over time. But even he said, you know, when you first said you were getting married, I thought, well, you know, what on earth? He says, however, he can genuinely see how happy the man makes me when his letters come through, when I'm on a visit, when I'm on the phone to him, how genuinely happy. And he says he's happy for me. And as far as my family goes, they're rather divided, to be honest, Sean. There's some of them that really don't want to hear anything about it and they're very concerned. And there are others who are far more liberal. Listen, I'm a grown-up 36-year-old woman. I'm almost 37. I'm not an 18-year-old young lady, so I know what I'm doing.
Yeah,
I know what I'm doing.
Have you set a date? Where will the marriage take place?
No, we've not set a date because he's got a parole hearing that's this summer, and so I mean, you know, we have to remember that although he's a notorious character, and now I've had some dealings with the media, he's still a real person, and he's still a prisoner, and I'm still a prisoner's fiancé. So when all that dies down, we still have to deal with the everyday situation and a parole hearing and getting that sorted and the right, and his solicitor and working with that is far more important for us than oh, quick, let's get married and have this, you know.
If the parole doesn't work out, though, Paula?
Well, the parole, when people get, I think, the wrong impression sometimes. When I say parole hearing, it's not, here's your parole, there are the keys, goodbye. It's to literally, and that's what my petition's about, just to raise awareness about this. This parole hearing would be a progression to work his way towards eventual release. It doesn't mean to get released. It means to get him off segregation, because right now he's in segregation. So he's in his cell for 23 hours a day. unless he's on a visit. And it would be to get him moved to a different lower security prison initially, back into the general population of with other prisoners, and to work his way towards his eventual release. So it wouldn't be tomorrow.
Yeah, but I suppose what I mean is that as things stand now, and that parole hearing, you haven't had it yet, is there any possibility of him being released?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, eventually he has to be. If a prisoner is well behaved, and he's certainly rehabilitated himself through his artwork. I get his reports in from the segregation unit where he is, so I'm privy to these reports that I send straight to his solicitor, and his behaviour is absolutely impeccable. He regularly sees a counsellor in there. He's done violence reduction courses. He concentrates on his artwork. It's a massive, massive amount for charity. So we're not dealing with. I mean, I think we hear the word Bronson and we see we think of the film that Tom Hardy played him. But the actual reality of the man is very, very different from that media portrayal of him.
Mm-hmm. Now, but presumably that means because he was extremely violent, the fact he's still in prison
because
he was extremely violent. How long was that process of change within him then?
I think the process of change has been happening for, I don't know, over the past decade or so. And I think it was about 2014 is when he tried to sort of bury the name Bronson, for want of a better word, and he's now actually, his name is by deed poll Charles Salvador.
Because of his painting.
He changed after the artist, but he changed that because he doesn't want this Bronson image that's hanging over him. And yes, he's committed many violent offences, many, and he's the first one and holds his hands up to all of those. However, he's served all his time for his offences, and he's actually 14 years over his tariff, which means he was sentenced to 3 years in 2000, and he's still in the same place that he went to, from Luton Crown Court straight to Wakefield, to the segregation block, and he's never left it since.
Mm-hmm.
He was 14 years over his tariff. So there's now that I'm the kind of person that wants these things investigated, we've got a new solicitor now, for example, that's really looking heavily into the case of Charles's, and he deserves a chance, like everybody else.
Now, obviously, Paula, you've received an awful lot of publicity since you announced the engagement. And there have been reports that prior to your relationship with Charles, that you that you were writing to Ian Brady.
Oh, God, yeah. Do you know what? This has been taken so out of context. It is insane.
Yeah.
I wrote to Brady when I was at drama school. So that would have been around 2002. When I was about 22, or it might have been 2003, when I was 23, because I was doing a play and I was trying to do some research, and I asked my tutor at the time if it was a good idea, and they said, well, you can do. It was a few letters exchanged, of which it soon became very apparent that this was a complete narcissistic, not obviously, what did I expect? Clearly he's going to be a narcissistic, evil psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was, obviously he's dead now. And it's blown out of proportion. It's made me out to be this person that's seeking out these violent men, all these horrible men. I mean, Brady and Charlie couldn't be any further removed if they tried. They completely... I've always been intrigued by true crime cases. Now, you know, people that have written series and series of books on the Moors murders and stayed in contact, journalists that have written to Ian Brady and stayed in contact for, you know, 30 years or more, they're not dragged over the hot coals. But because I'm a female engaged to Charlie Salvador, I'm dragged over the coals. So, you know, unnecessarily. So that's the truth. That's the truth of the matter. So there you go.
Paula, well, thanks for clearing that up. Paula Williamson.
No problem.
Thank you very much for talking to us today,
No
Paula.
Problem. Thank you.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big cheque for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.